There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile, hour number two on this Monday. And wow, it looks like still messed up. 65 southbound. We had that accident about 45 minutes to an hour ago. They're coming in about 45 minutes. Oh, gosh, yeah, it's been about an hour. 65 southbound at Highway 45 at that interchange. 65 southbound. They had at least a two-car accident there. Bad accident, what y'all are texting me and telling me here out there. But still, an hour later, it's still slow going southbound. So I don't know if they have... I don't know if they have a lane open. We're still looking for more information. And Philip, in there, in the if we can get something, if you look, if they have a... If you look at some of our sources there, if we've got any of those lanes open and traveling, or if you're in that area, is it a no-go or a slow go 65 southbound at 45? We know it's a slow go, but is it completely blocked, or are they letting vehicles through? We'll keep our eyes on that, let y'all know as soon as we get that information. And I'd like to say hello to my buddy Cameron Smith from the R Street Institute and AL.com, joining us to talk about a lot here on... By the way, today is National Fishing Day. Did you see that?
I did not know, since it's apparently a national some kind of day every day now.
Yes, it is, actually, and it's multiple. There are layers of National Something Day. I just would suggest, they said it's observed. I would figure just you do that on a weekend. Although I know people work shift work, and a lot of people, today's their day off, but you figure National Fishing Day, they want us to celebrate it. Let's do it on a Saturday. Let's do it on a Sunday.
Totally agree. Seems reasonable.
I don't know why they're National Go Fishing Day observed on June 18th. So there it is. All right. Lots to talk about here back home in the state of Alabama. And the ads are already running here on FM Talk 106.5, of course, on television and in print as we're getting ready for the runoff. The one that has a lot of people talking, how early it has started. And of course, the question was, why so much money in it in the primary, but now in the runoff? So early, the ads are running for Lieutenant Governor of the state of Alabama, a showdown between Representative Will Ainsworth and PSC heiress, I'm sorry, PSC Director Twinkle Kavanaugh.
Yeah, Sean, this one is funny. The clear angles for attack were kind of laid out, and I said, Will Ainsworth needs to brand Twinkle as the sort of special interest acolyte of Alabama power, and she needs to just sort of pull the KIV and ignore him and act as if he's a non-candidate. Instead, they both ignored me, and they went out with hand slapping. They just basically decided, we're going to get in a slap fight with each other. And it really, I get it. I understand that going negative is, every political consultant says, hey, that's what sticks. That's what they tell these folks. And then they do. But, I mean, this one, the back and forth here just looks kind of ridiculous.
Well, it's a continuation of a tact that was used by not just folks in Lieutenant Governor's race, but all through the primaries, of, you know, the Kenneth Moss Trumpy. I mean, it was the, I am the anointed Trump candidate. And, you know, we talk about when everybody claims to be the Trump candidate, then no one is the Trump candidate, but they're back to it. Okay, you've seen this from the inside. You worked in Washington, you've worked in Alabama politics, you've watched these folks. Is this coming from the consultants? Are the consultants saying, what you need to talk about is who's on Trump's side and who isn't?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been sort of a conventional play since Trump was successful. The hilarious aspect here is Trump is almost a magical figure that is whatever candidates want him to be. For example, Kavanaugh is going after Ainsworth for his statements during the campaign, pointing out that Donald Trump is not a conservative. Incidentally, Donald Trump is somebody who said that he's not a conservative. he describes himself as somewhat conservative.
Right.
But that doesn't fit the narrative in Alabama. Trump needs to be an arch conservative. And so Kavanaugh is essentially attacking Ainsworth for saying something that Trump himself said about Trump. And that's how ridiculous this has become.
Well, I mean, that and that it's happening. I mean, obviously, Lieutenant Governor is a big name position, I guess, but it is surprising me there's so much interest in this.
It doesn't surprise me at all, and I've written as much that this Lieutenant Governor's race is a KIV insurance policy. People kind of got that from the last go-round with Bentley. Nobody was prepared for KIV to become governor. Nobody. I mean, if you look at campaign finance records, you see how little people cared about the last Lieutenant Governor race. Now, because I think of Ivy's age, questions about her health, there's a pretty good interest in, hey, this person in the Lieutenant Governor's race, whoever prevails, could be very likely governor at some point. And I think that's the way people are looking at it. That's the reason you got millions of dollars in this race where previously no one cared. Is because they look at it political. The Alabama's political infrastructure looks at this as an insurance policy for the governor's mansion.
a value price purchase. But what about KIV makes somebody think she's not? Let's just get down to it. Is it an age thing? What about that makes them think that KIV doesn't finish out if she wins now a full term?
Well, I think it's two things. One, it is age and questions that have been raised about her health. Obviously, she's under no obligation to release her health records or talk about her personal health conditions. That's certainly fine. But those questions have been raised. And then there's just the situation that happened with Governor Bentley, the fact that nobody really paid attention to the lieutenant governor's position. And then, obviously, KIV became governor. And so I think a lot of folks are saying they don't want to be caught off guard with who's in that lieutenant governor's spot, and that's the reason you see the money that you do in the race right now.
All right. I saw this, too. This popped up a second ago, that Countryman on the Democrat side is now I don't know how this is a big play, because I don't know when he finished up with 2% of the vote or something, but Countryman refuses to endorse Walt Maddox and is going to continue campaigning as a write-in in the mix. So that affects things by, 1.5%, 0.7%? What do you think?
I'd go more like 0.02.
Okay.
We're talking a handful of votes, but ultimately it's going to come down to people who support Mr. Countryman can either support Walt Maddox or KIV. You pick, because otherwise it ain't going to matter.
Right. What about the idea that was floated around during the primary by the OTIs, the other than Ivies on the Republican side, that said, hey, listen, I don't think it's anything new, but they said, hey, listen, you got to vote for me. The reason you got to vote for me is that Maddox is going to mop the floor with KIV. They're going to do young versus old, new ideas versus no idea, so you got to get me in there. Was there any truth to that?
Sure. If KIV was, playing one-on-one basketball, yeah, absolutely. I mean, but to extend the metaphor, Ivy is not going to get on that court with Walt Maddox. Her consultants are going to tell her, button this up, ignore him, keep shaking hands, kissing babies, talking about how much you love being governor of Alabama and serving the people of Alabama, and don't give him any hooks to attack you with. And I think she'll continue that strategy. I think that while I believe leaders show up, I think that you can't ever be afraid of your opposition or afraid they might mop the floor with you. You need to have those debates. You need to have those exchanges. I just don't see a world in which Ivy's handlers think it's a good idea for her to get on stage with Walt Maddox. And frankly, I don't think the people of Alabama are going to force the issue.
All right, coming back, more with Cameron Smith from the R Street Institute and AL.com right here on Midday Mobile. Check my Twitter feed. Something just bubbled up in Alabama politics. I think it's going to have people talking a whole bunch. We'll do it when we get back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 120 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile, Monday style. Glad you are here. And good to talk to my buddy Cameron Smith from the R Street Institute and AL.com. And we're in a discussion of Alabama politics, which, by the way, somebody was asking me earlier, runoff coming up July 17th. Also, update on the traffic. It looks like far left lane, 65 southbound open, but a real slow go. This is once again at the Highway 45 interchange, 65 southbound at Highway 45. There was an accident there. They have the far left lane open, but other than that, they are closed, so it is very slow going through there. Obviously, if you can get off before then, get off at Industrial or do something like that, and bring 45 down and either go University the whole way in, or maybe get on the service road down there and go that way. You can get out of that big traffic jam. We'll keep our eyes on this for you and continue our conversation with Cameron Smith. And, okay, during the break, I said there was something had happened here, and we're talking about Alabama politics, and this is absolutely about Alabama politics. News breaking here over the last 3 or 4 minutes, Cameron, coming up on the Alabama Political Reporter's website. They said they've obtained a copy of a letter in which Alabama Power CEO Mark Crosswhite makes it clear to the BCA, Business Council of Alabama, Chairman Perry Hand, and executive committee members why the company is pulling its support. They said they said they're effective immediately withdrawing their membership from BCA. Said, we have become concerned that membership in BCA has become a liability rather than a benefit. Crosswhite further writes, to be candid, BCA has needlessly alienated federal and state officials, failed to communicate with its own members, squandered our collective corporate goodwill, allowed its financial health to decline, and become a divisive force in our state. Cameron, kind of lay it out for us here, what this means. And, you know, people often hear about the BCA and, oh, it's the Business Council of Alabama, and it might be a boogeyman and for one campaign and an ally in another. What is BCA, and what does it mean for Alabama Power to be pulling out?
Well, this is a big deal, but BCA, when your listeners hear about the Business Council of Alabama, it's one of the biggest players in Alabama politics, particularly for Republicans. The BCA under the leadership of, I guess, when Sandy Stimson was chairman of the board, made some real tough decisions and decided that instead of going from just sort of go along with the Democrats in the state government, decided to sort of chart a new course and was instrumental in electing Republican majorities in 2010 and really changing the makeup of the state legislature. Very close with former Speaker Hubbard, had a tremendous amount of pull. Over the last couple of years, there have been questions about their effectiveness, whether they could move things through the legislature as they once could, particularly after the fall of Speaker Hubbard, and whether they were winning in their political investments. The dollars that they were spending, they're essentially a trade association of the business community in Alabama. And, you know, the dollars that they pushed through their progress pack, they were losing a lot of elections and have struggled in some of them. And the questions now are about leadership at the top. And this seems to me like a power play from Alabama Power to say, hey, we're going to force a leadership change or try. And that's obviously not good news for Billy Canary, but there have been questions swirling for a while now as to what was going to happen. The question is whether BCA and its leadership want to stay the course without Alabama Power or try to make some changes that maybe woo them back to the table.
Okay, Cameron, help me. Is it just in your estimation right now that the political climate has changed or the BCA is failing? In other words, it could be failing, but I guess why it's failing. Is it because that the conservative message has gone, you know, people say, well, it's gone grassroots, it's gone populist, and it's contrary to what the business council would want? Or is it that the BCA is not being run efficiently like they're intimating in this letter?
Well, to be very clear, there's still some fantastic people at BCA. They've got some great staff. very capable staff who understand the political landscape, know what's going on. A little bit of the challenge I suspect the BCA has is it has a very broad membership, and it's hard to generate consensus on a lot of things. But also what you pointed to with the rise of populism, that an entity that represents the business interests in Alabama, particularly the larger business interests, is seen as the political elite, part of the swamp at times. And I think that's a little bit of what we're feeling here, that historically folks looked at the big business in Alabama and said, hey, you know, you're here to grow the state, to create more opportunity. And I think some folks have just soured on that and said, hey, you're not growing opportunity. You're not creating more opportunity for everybody. You're creating, you know, preserving your piece of the pie, but not trying to grow the pie for everybody. And I think that has absolutely played a role in some of the political battles and some of the characterization of the BCA.
Yeah, it's interesting as well that you have, at least in the story, it goes on to say, Bill Britt writes here, the canary is persona non grata in the offices of Alabama's powerful Republican U.S. Senator Richard Shelby. As a result, he is shunned by most in the Alabama delegation. At the Alabama State House, Canary has accumulated more enemies than friends and increasingly finds himself isolated. I just, you know, when I see that, I wonder, is it that the person has changed or the playing field's changed? You know, and we just got done talking about, you know, the next round of ads for somebody saying, well, no, they don't like Trump and I love Trump. No, I love Trump and they don't like Trump. That maybe there's some of that, you know, that the person's still doing the same thing, but the winds have changed.
Sure, but there's also one thing to remember is take what Bill Britt writes with a grain of salt.
Sure,
his displeasure towards BCA,
anything
Hubbard acolytes, Billy Canary.
Yes,
he's been very anti all of that for a very long time.
Very much so.
Some of his characterization is influenced by that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about that. How, you know, this, you know, in the state of Alabama, there's a lot of news or news/blogs out there that have a backing of other groups. And it's made for a confusing landscape. But I guess what we can say about this in the factual side is, unless they're just making up whole cloth, that this letter did go from Alabama Power to BCA, said they're out. Where do they take their might, right? I mean, Alabama Power, at least for a guy like me on the outside, I've always been told, now they're the big player. They're going to, you know, put money in here or there or make this move or not make that move. Where would they go with that?
Well, right now, things are very, very interesting for the power company, for Southern Company in general, because energy markets are changing. The way we look at energy and power distribution is changing. They had a big investment in Mississippi that ended up being billions of dollars more expensive than they had anticipated. And ratepayers in Mississippi and their politicians basically said, wait, we don't want to pay for your cost overruns. And I think that that's one of the challenges that Alabama Power and Southern Company have now, is that you've got more informed consumers saying, wait a minute, this whole rate basing model where we basically pay for you to build stuff that then you use to charge us may not be the best model for us to get electricity. That's never happened to them before. And so this is a different climate. And I think they're probably, if I had to guess, going to focus more specifically on their individual issues in the energy market space rather than, you know, say, business issues generally.
Okay, what about that? Because you watch this with R Street. You're talking about free markets and the benefit of free markets. Are there models elsewhere in the country when it comes to energy that Alabama could learn a lesson from?
Yeah, Texas is a perfect example. They're trying to create options for consumers, whether it's regarding energy mix, whether it's service. Just injecting more choice into the equation. This is one of the oddities, I would say, of our political space. Essentially, the model we use in Alabama that many other states use is a monopoly. Well, conservatives really don't like monopolies, generally speaking. We like free markets. We like competition. Some of the things that may have been true previously about why that might have been necessary just don't necessarily apply in the same way anymore. We have better technology, for example. And it's a question that particularly a lot of Republicans need to be asking is, do we need to support the monopoly structure, or should we start looking for better market-oriented ways to give consumers choices when it comes to things like their power bill?
There we go. It's Cameron Smith, R Street Institute and AL.com. Somebody wants to reach out and engage you in conversation, where's the best place to go?
You can find me at D Cameron Smith on Twitter or at AL.com/opinion.
By the way, once again, National Go Fishing Day, so you know, good thing we're not in the same town. We would just waste the afternoon going fishing on a Monday.
Sounds like a plan.
It's a good one. Thank you, Cameron. All right, coming back, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Smith of Auburn University about the new Wildlife Enterprise Management degree. Okay, now this is within the School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences at Auburn, but to get you ready to go run a, I guess, a hunting or fishing operation, canoeing operation, I don't know, we'll get the exact details from Dr. Mark Smith. Like I said, if you got a kid who's getting ready for college, this may be right up their alley. Listen up, we're coming right back with that.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 135, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Monday. Glad to have you here. Remember, the discussion continues on our Facebook page, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5. I mentioned earlier, of course, we podcast all the live local organic shows we do during the week, and this might be one of them that you want to listen to and then share with somebody in your family, or possibly share with a friend who has a person who would like to get into the world of wildlife and business going forward, because a brand new degree being launched at Auburn University to help introduce students and get them to secure jobs in the hunting and fishing business world. Now, I want to make sure we get this correct, so we bring in one of the people that put this together, Dr. Mark Smith, and the new Wildlife Enterprise Management degree program at the School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences at Auburn. Dr. Smith, thanks for your time. Thanks for being on with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, so tell me about this. So this degree is what, like, you know, we talk about forestry and wildlife sciences. I think about the people I know that work with the state DCNR and friends of mine. They went to Auburn. They have a wildlife science degree. But this is a little bit different, right? Reading through this, this is a new wrinkle.
Sure. This degree really focuses on customer service, business management, and also the resource. Whereas, like our wildlife and forestry degrees, most students that come to Auburn for those degrees, they go out and work for an agency, whether state or federal agency, or maybe a consulting group. Students that come in for our wildlife enterprise management degree are going to be working for businesses, mainly consumptive use businesses, hunting and fishing lodges, and so forth. So it is a little bit different than our traditional degrees in the School of Forest and Wildlife Sciences.
I mean, will they still know some of the science of the wildlife and the fisheries, and then get business with it, or is it all business? What's the ratio there?
It's about a third. It's about a third split. We kind of view it as three things that students get out of this program. They have to have some basic fundamental understanding about how to manage the resource, the wildlife resource, the fishery resource, to understand what it can and can't do in terms of providing outdoor recreational opportunities. Then we have two other segments which kind of get out of the management of natural game or non-game management, more focus on the customer side of things. Working with our College of Human Sciences here, we have several hospitality courses which are put into this curriculum to focus on the customer. Because a lot of cases, when you're working for a hunting and fishing lodge, really the person that the thing that you're working for is the customer, to ensure that they have a good, sound, enjoyable outdoor experience. And so our students have to be prepared from the hospitality management. And then thirdly is the enterprise management, or the actual business management of a lodge facility. We'll have courses in accounting, management, and so forth. In fact, students come out with a minor in business after completing the Wildlife Enterprise Management degree. So there's three cornerstones to this degree: understanding the management of the resource, understanding the customer or how to accommodate customers, and then third, understanding the business management side of a facility.
I'm talking to Dr. Mark Smith with the Auburn School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences. So if you and Dr. Dishkoff created this new degree, then there must be demand out there, right? How does that simmer up? How do you find out that there's a need for this set of these parameters, these skills?
You know, we've worked with several folks. At least we got outside input, folks outside the university. One of those is John Burrell, High Adventure Company out of Atlanta or just north of Atlanta, who works with a lot of hunting and fishing facilities in this whole entire industry. And getting a lot of feedback from him and a few others, we've really found out that there's not any program other than Kansas State University, the only other university in the country offering a similar program, where we're putting out students that are well qualified in these three different distinct areas: the resource and the customer, and then of course the business management. And just from what we're seeing and our sponsor we've been getting, it's been very favorable. Folks have been really looking forward to seeing some of our students get out and start taking some of these jobs. But yeah, the demand is definitely there, because there's no curriculum that prepares these students in these three different segments of how to run a business.
Yeah, because I'm now looking at things from the other side of life as a parent, and I would want to know if my son or daughter wanted to get into this. You know, I'm going to ask you, so what kind of jobs are there, doctor? I mean, come on. And it sounds like there's some. I'm thinking about the High Adventure Company. It actually runs a place right there at the mouth of the Mississippi River at Port Eads down there. So I would know there's... So in doing this, you've mentioned customer and human sciences, and that's the friends of mine that work in this industry as well on the guiding side have told me a million times. They said, listen, we're not in the hunting or fishing business, we're in the entertainment business.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that's seemingly true by you offering the kind of the disciplines here.
Yeah, that's very true. You are somewhat in the entertainment business, but really the customer experience business. And it obviously wraps together in the same one. But you have to be knowledgeable about the actual business side of things and also the resource. And that's what I think is one of the key for this degree program, is gives that students exposure to each of those three cornerstones of a hunting, fishing, lodge facility.
Now those are... I mean, I think about it through the state of Alabama and some of the initiatives the state has taken on. Do other states do the same thing? You know, we have the Quail Trail here and the different initiatives in the Black Belt. Is that happening? Is that happening elsewhere?
We see the outdoor industry growing, definitely by all means, whether it's a quail shooting facility all the way up to, you know, high-end offshore fishing lodge, you know, in Panama or Costa Rica, to safari companies in southern Africa and central Africa, or even out west here in the United States, whether it's a hunting or fishing lodge. That business definitely seems to be growing, and they just don't have a good pool of qualified folks to take those jobs. And if you think about it, most people who are currently working those positions in those hunting and fishing lodges are either people who had a passion for hunting and fishing and want to get into it. They understand wildlife management, but they didn't understand the business or customer management. And so they learned through the school of hard knocks. Or you may have someone who's a business person, went to college, got an MBA in business, they're outdoor enthusiasts, and they say, you know, this isn't the right business for me. I want to get into providing outdoor experiences. They get into it, they don't understand managing the resource. And so that's where I think it positions our students uniquely, in that they get a good foundational knowledge or experience in those three different categories of how to manage the actual resource, how to work with customers, and then finally how to manage a business. Because that's what all these things are. They are business. They are for-profit type of businesses where I see our students going.
Yeah, I do see somewhat of a, and I don't know, at your level, you see all of it, but kind of a resurgence maybe in interest. It comes from the food, you know, the localized food movement or something like that, people that are 20 years my junior seem to be getting back into, or at least interested in outdoor pursuits, whether they're consumptive or non-consumptive. But the consumptive part, it seems to have with this kind of foodie movement. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I definitely say, you know, the locavore movement, folks are a little bit more concerned now, or at least some segment of the population, where their food's coming from, how it's handled, whether it has antibiotics, hormones, or so forth added to it. So you do see that increase in that sector of the population getting into, say, hunting or fishing, for example.
This is interesting. Okay, I think you probably raised a lot of eyebrows out here. People that may want it for themselves, or parents that think, hey, maybe that's my child, or a friend of the family. How do they, if they're interested in this, how do they get more information? Do they go to the front door of Auburn University, or how do they get more details here?
you just go right online to the School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences at Auburn University, and should have our degree program information up on there. You can also contact our Student Services office. That's the direct link our staff here to help students become enrolled in the program. Or contact me at Auburn University. Easily Google me up, Mark Smith, Auburn University, School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences. I'm more than happy to talk with any prospective students or parents about the outlook for this new degree.
All right, good deal. Now, I'm in the beginning of my midlife crisis, so maybe would you accept a 46-year-old freshman?
We sure would. We'll take any student out there. And, of course, in all seriousness, that could be reality. There may be some folks who want to come back and retool from what they did in a previous career, or they're perhaps retired from a 25-year career in some other field and want to come back and retool. This can be another option for those folks. Again, to get back into something that they're really, really passionate about, and that's what you generally find people who are hunting and fishing.
Wow. Best of luck with this, Dr. Smith. I'm going to keep up with how y'all do, and we'll check back.
Sounds great.
All right, Dr. Mark Smith checking in. There it is. More detail on that story, Auburn offering that new outdoor recreation degree. Kid in your family, does that apply to? Are you the kid in your family? All right, coming right back. More Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 152 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Reading through some of the text coming in here. Yeah, if you go to my Twitter feed, there's a link to more information about that degree. And I appreciate Dr. Smith coming on with us about the new degree at the Auburn School of Forestry. All right. I wanted to mention earlier two stories that make it scary to work in the yard. And by the way, got something pretty cool coming your way soon. Could debut it this week. What has been working in my yard? And you've seen a Roomba before, the automated robot. What if you could do the same thing for your yard? Got something that is operating in the Sullivan yards, going to blow your mind. I'd like to tell you it's brand new technology, but it's been around for 20 years, but it's new technology to a lot of us. And we're going to talk about what Husqvarna has brought to the marketplace here very, very soon. But I mentioned the yard stories. There were two of them that got my attention here. Number one, an AL.com story about some stats for riding lawnmowers. Now listen to the, we're not talking about racing them either, like I have kinfolk that do. They really do. They soup them up and race them. They have races, and I have a cousin that's pretty good at it. But a story from Lita Gore over at AL.com said, this weekend's death of an Alabama man highlights the dangers that come with operating a riding lawnmower. Then she goes into some stats. Now y'all put on that seatbelt that you never put on the riding lawnmower and listen to this. Okay, lawnmower injuries sent more than 80,000 people, including 5,000 children, to U.S. emergency rooms in the year 2015, according to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Lawnmowers are especially dangerous for children, cited by the Amputee Coalition as the number one reason for pediatric amputations nationwide. According to the commission, 800 children are run over by riding mowers or small tractors each year, and more than 600 of those incidents resulted in amputation. Gosh, this is scary stuff. Lawnmower injuries have been blamed for an average of 70 deaths annually, according to the CPSC. Injuries range from people falling or slipping in front or on or off a mower, burns, amputations from blades, danger from projectiles thrown from the lawnmower, or in the Alabama case this weekend, rollovers. But I'll say, because if you get on a riding lawnmower or tractor these days, there are more safety features on those things. You can't get off the mower without it turning off. You can't do this. They've checked everything you would do, it seems to me, to put yourself in danger. They've got a fail-safe for it, but it's still, listen to those stats. Alabama Department of Public Health says, here's some tips for safety. Children should be at least 12 before they operate any lawnmower. At least 16 for a riding lawnmower. Children should never be passengers on ride-on lawnmowers. Always wear sturdy shoes while mowing, not sandals. Young children should be at a safe distance from the area you're mowing. Now, that's the one that can get you, right? You can do everything right safety-wise, but if there's rocks or junk in the grass and that blade hits it and it didn't get caught by the deck, it can get thrown. I know there's a lot of windows in town that have succumbed to that. Young children, they say, should be a safe distance from the area you're mowing. I think that's probably sage advice. Before mowing, pick up stones, toy, and debris from the lawn to prevent injuries from flying objects. Well, listen, if we saw it, we wouldn't have run over it, Alabama Department of Public Health. Always wear eye and hearing protection. Use a mower with control that stops it from moving forward once the handle is released. That's almost all of them, I think, these days. Never pull backwards or mow in reverse unless absolutely necessary. Well, maybe guilty of that. Just there's that one spot in the yard. Start and refuel mower outdoor, not in the garage. Blade settings should be set by an adult only. All right, wait for blades. Some of these are just common sense. Wait for the blades to stop. Here, this is a good one. Wait for them to stop before crossing a gravel road, obviously, to keep from having the projectiles. And when purchasing a lawnmower, look for machines that have forward control mechanism that stops the machine from moving once the handle's released. I think that's all of them, isn't it? I don't know that you can get one that doesn't have that these days. Okay, so that's one of the stories. Some of those stats I thought were surprising, at least to me. And then this other story, that, and we'll watch where this goes. A story, again, it's a lawsuit against Monsanto. Monsanto, who makes Roundup, which is the brand name glyphosate, right? The kill-all, you know, not specific herbicide, but a kill-all herbicide. Except for some stuff. There's a trial. This guy, Lee Johnson, he has deadly case of cancer, and his attorneys are claiming that it comes from Roundup. The 46-year-old is now the first in line to go to trial against the agrochemical giant among thousands of people across the U.S. who blame the herbicide for their disease. As a groundskeeper for the school district of Benicia, California, about 40 miles east of San Francisco, Johnson mixed and sprayed hundreds of gallons of Roundup. He was diagnosed with cancer in 2014, and in July, after chemotherapy and other treatment, his oncologist gave him 6 months to live. Glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, was first approved for use back in 1974. So it goes on in the story, and I'll put it up on the Twitter feed, but they say, you know, this trial is a canary in a coal mine, and there's a lot of people watching it. Can you imagine, depending on the precedent here, if they show they think Roundup is a cause of cancer, how many people and it doesn't mean that it's linked for sure, but how many people have used Roundup and then have gotten cancer? This is going to be very interesting. They say, Monsanto says, glyphosate is the most tested herbicide in history. They feel like they're on the good here. They feel like it is not the cause of the cancer, but these attorneys are arguing this. And we'll see what happens here. And they said in the pretrial ruling allows Johnson lawyers to try to use internal Monsanto correspondence to show that the company has been aware of the risk of its herbicides being a carcinogen. Now, think about how it went down with the cigarette. Remember how they got this and they got the documents and they said, here, the companies knew as of whatever date that these cigarettes were causing cancer. What if that happens with Roundup, something that's not labeled as, you know, being dangerous? I don't know. Yes, I got Roundup concentrate sitting at the garage at my house. I don't know if I can go spray this afternoon or not, but there you go. I'll put this story up on the Twitter feed, and we'll do this all again tomorrow morning, bright and early, for Mobile Mornings. Be back again tomorrow for Midday Mobile. Paul Feinbaum Show is on the way next. Y'all have a great one.